What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the 101st episode of the Crazy One Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Stephen Gates, and this intro is going to be different because this show is going to be different. Hopefully by now, you have either heard or seen that I'm joining the Share the Mic Now movement. This is the first episode in what's going to be a series where I'm going to be turning over this show to a bunch of different Black, Brown, Indigenous, and LGBTQ plus people in the industry because I think they're voices that we need to hear from. Now, whenever I started this, I'd sent out a bunch of emails, I'd done a couple posts in different design communities, hoping that somebody was going to want to take part in this, but I had no real idea. Now, I know that it didn't happen instantly, but it definitely felt instant that I got a reply. And the first reply that just simply said, like, I'm in and I'm interested was from Maurice Cherry. And Maurice is somebody that I have so much respect for so many different reasons. I think he is just a truly pioneering digital creator. He is probably most well known for his award-winning weekly podcast, Revision Path. It launched in 2013. I'm pretty sure he's on episode 453 now, of just doing these incredible in-depth interviews and really showcasing Black designers, developers, and digital creatives from all over the world. I remember back in 2015, he did an incredible podcast at South by Southwest called Where Are All the Black Designers? He has just been such an essential voice in the industry for me that I was just blown away that he wanted to do this. And again, I think you can see that impact that his show was the first one, the first podcast that was added to the permanent collection of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. And he said, look, whenever I do want to do this, I have somebody in mind that I want to talk to. And then whenever he came back and told me who that was, I was blown away all over again. So this is a conversation between Maurice and Debbie Millman. And I think probably both of them need no introduction. But if you, for some reason, have been living under a rock, Debbie was somebody who was called one of the most creative people in the business by Fast Company for a reason. The breadth of her work is hard to be able to capture because I think she is an author, an educator, a curator. She has been the host of Design Matters podcast, which, you know, look, this is one of the world's first and longest running podcasts, and she's interviewed nearly 500 artists, designers, and cultural commentators over the span of 14 years. I am so incredibly humbled to be able to have this conversation happen here, and so I simply would just love to be able to introduce Maurice Cherry and Debbie Millman.
All right, so tell us who you are and what you do.
Hi, Maurice. My name is Debbie Millman, and I am a designer, an author, an educator, and host of the podcast Design Matters.
Now, one thing that I've been asking everyone that I've talked to pretty much this year, pretty much since March, is how are you holding up during this time of quarantine?
Oh, good question. Big question. Up and down. I moved to Los Angeles to be with my fiance in March. She and I have been in a long distance relationship since our relationship began several years ago. And we decided back in early March that it was probably better for me to come to Los Angeles than her to come to New York. We'd have more space in Los Angeles and more sunshine. So I came here mid-March. And at the time she said, pack for 2 weeks. And now it's been almost 4 months. But on the one hand, it's been really extraordinary to be with her every day. We're together 24/7 and have really moved into a very different aspect of our relationship, which has been extraordinarily wonderful for me. And I'm loving being with her so much. On the other hand, it's been really hard to see what's going on in the world. And it was also hard on a very sort of molecular level for me to move from New York City, where I've been my whole life, to the West Coast, where I've never lived. I've actually never been outside of New York for the amount of time I've been outside of New York now in my entire life. And I'm, you know, nearly 59. So that's saying a lot. And it was also hard to move my graduate program that I have at School of Visual Arts, which is a very intensive 5-day-a-week in-person experience, to a completely online experience. And that was a real learning curve for me because I'm a bit of a Luddite. So to have to manage, just technologically, aside from all the emotional stuff, just technologically managing Zoom and Canvas and Slack. I mean, there was moments where I was projectile crying because I couldn't figure it out. And being in a different time zone and scheduling meetings for the wrong time and, you know, all that ridiculous stuff. But now I'm really happily settled in Los Angeles and watching the world burn down and then remake itself in ways that I think are necessary, but also just having to deal with the politics because I just can't handle who is leading our country and how he's leading our country. And it's so destructive and so dangerous that that's been just completely devastating.
Wow.
So, yeah, short answer.
I guess, I'll ask, have you kind of gotten a rhythm down now? Like, what is a typical day like for you these days?
Yeah, I have gotten a rhythm down. Well, one of the things that I started doing when I got to Los Angeles was making a garden. And I had started just a little sort of container garden in Roxanne's backyard about a year or so ago. And then when I got here full time, I started to create a vegetable garden. And so I do that every day. And we have this extraordinary vegetable garden with tomatoes and cucumbers, two kinds of cucumbers, Japanese cucumbers and lemon cucumbers and two kinds of tomatoes and two kinds of lettuces and radishes and carrots and peppers and string beans and snow peas. And we're starting to get corn and lemons and limes and Satsuma oranges that are growing. So that's been, for the first time in my life, I'm doing something I've never done in the garden before. So that's been amazing. We're both night owls, so we stay up to like ridiculously late hours, talking, reading, watching TV. And so I get up usually around 9 o'clock or so and spend some time in the garden and have a lot of meetings and do some writing, do some artwork. I've been doing some really interesting projects, which I'm really happy about. And then most of the afternoon is spent online with my students and the program. My students don't graduate until the middle of July. So right now we're like deep in thesis. And Roxanne cooks almost every day. And so that's been amazing. We have dinner every night together and doing my podcast and just trying to keep busy, but also have enough space to be thinking and reading and educating myself a lot on what's happening in the world with the deconstruction of some of the white supremacist models that we've been living in and trying to understand the history and just doing a lot of reading and learning and talking with Roxanne about it.
Has it been such a, well, it sounds like it's been a big departure just from the way things were prior to this, but I think that's kind of a shared grief that we all have, you know. We were all, like, I know I had so many plans in February before all this was going on. Right. And then coronavirus happened. Well, the coronavirus had been happening prior to that, but it had made its way to the United States and then lockdown procedures. And then I just ended up canceling everything for the year because I felt like even if things started to reach some level of normalcy, it was just going to take a while for everyone to get on board in general. And I think what we're seeing now with cases rising and states going back into lockdown procedures, that we're in this for the duration, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. My brother is a doctor and works in with geriatric patients. And so most of the work that he does is in nursing homes. So he's seen the destruction very early on, and he's been keeping me posted on what's happening. And it's just terribly, terribly sad. It's just devastating. And to hear how we are treating our elders, you know, I think in a lot of ways, the way we treat the elders in our country is very much indicative of how badly we treat people in a lot of ways. And to see how much death there is in nursing homes is just outrageous. It's just outrageous. Of course, my brother got very sick as well. He's better now, thank goodness. But he did get sick as well.
Some of the projects that you're doing, can you talk a little bit about what those are? Like when I go to your website, I know you have writing and branding and books and commentary. What sort of projects are you doing now?
Well, I've been doing a number of different pro bono projects. I was doing some work for something called Merch Aid, which is to help small businesses that have had to close because of COVID raise money through customized merchandise. And I know that, so I did work for the Astoria Bookshop, which is in Queens. I did pro bono work to help communicate being together but apart for COVID, for Poster House. And I work on two boards, which I do a lot of work for. One of them is the Joyful Heart Foundation, and that was started in 2004 by Mariska Hargitay, who's the star of Law & Order SVU. And when she first started the show, she started getting letters from people. SVU stands for Special Victims Unit, and it's about sexually based crimes. And so she started to get a lot of letters from people that had been the victim of these crimes. And so she started a foundation to help eradicate domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse. And so I got involved with that organization first through another organization called No More, which was a consortium of a group of different nonprofits that were all working to try to end sexual violence. And so I did the branding of No More with Christine Mao, who at the time was the design director at Kimberly Clark. And then through that experience was invited to help Joyful Heart. And so I started working with them as well, repositioning and redesigning their identity. And then was asked to join the board probably about probably more like 5 years ago at this point. And now I'm the chair of the board. And so the primary work that we're doing now is to eradicate the rape kit backlog in the country, which is also quite egregious. And so I do that work. And then I also am working with an organization in New York called Performance Space New York, which was started by artist squatters back in the 80s. And then we're able to get a long-term lease for the work. And so Performance Space is all about bringing new work to the world. And it's all about very much more experimental, sort of cutting edge performance. So I do a lot of that. I spend a lot of time working on both of those boards and trying to raise money and just trying to keep them going and do some good in the world. And I have my program at the School of Visual Arts, and that takes a lot of time. It's a 10.5-month program, graduate program on branding. And then I'm doing my podcast as best as I can, which also is technologically really challenging. And several months ago, almost a year ago, I think at this point, Steve Heller, Laura Desenfant, Deb Aldridge, Andrew Gibbs, and Jessica Desio and I all came together to acquire Print Magazine out of bankruptcy, which had gone dark. And so I've been working on helping to relaunch that. Oh, and I'm doing quite a bit of writing, and I'm doing a series of videos right now for TED, the TED conference, one online this year. And so I was commissioned to do four little visual stories. I've been doing visual stories on my website, on my Instagram for about the last year or so. And So I was commissioned to do four of those. And so the first one was on gardening. The second one was on New York City. The third one was on travel. And now this last one is on community. And so that'll be coming out next week. And then I think they'll go up on the TED website. I'm really proud of this work. It's a whole new body of work for me. And I'm really excited about starting this sort of new thing.
Well, I got to say, if there's anybody that's making the best out of their quarantine time, it's you.
I don't know.
I mean,
the nice thing about it as well as being in one place for so long is that I've really been diligent with my therapy.
I mean, my goodness. I mean, I'm thinking like everyone has 24 hours in a day, but you've managed to really get a lot out of it. If you're doing, I mean, I imagine not doing all of this every day, but not this is a lot day. to kind of have them at one time.
I don't have children. We don't have children. We both love to work side by side. So we, you know, we spend a lot of time doing parallel working, as I call it. And it's, none of it feels laborious. You know, it all feels really important and work that I have my whole heart in. So I feel lucky in that regard.
Let's talk about print magazine. You mentioned parent company had filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And then you and Steve, et cetera, had sort of bought it, rescued it, you know from bankruptcy.
Yeah, it wasn't just me and Steve. So what happened was Steve and I wanted to. I had been trying. So I was the editorial and creative director for several years, 2015 to 17, something like that. And mm-hmm. then when the owners decided to stop publishing the print edition, I resigned because I felt like they were just not respecting the legacy and the heritage of what I considered to be a national treasure in a lot of ways. Because I sort of saw the writing on the wall, I asked if there would be any chance that I could acquire the magazine. And initially, they seemed to consider the possibility really seriously. I was very excited. And that was just me by myself. Mm-hmm. And part of what I was trying to do at the time, I had never, ever accepted ads. Well, no, I shouldn't say never, ever. I hadn't accepted ads for Design Matters in probably over a decade and decided I would start accepting ads so that I could, in some ways, rob Peter to pay Paul. I wanted to raise money for the magazine. And so I started doing that. And then and they sort of led me on a bit, I have to say. They, you know, we met, we started to talk about what kind of numbers, and then just when I got really excited, they were like, "Oop, nope, sorry, we don't want to sell it." And they gave me all kinds of bizarre and untrue reasons as to why. But they actually offered to let me buy the print magazine, but not the URL or the social media. So I'm like, wait a minute, what are you actually selling me? and that was that. And then they tried to keep it going and it obviously wasn't working. And so maybe a year went by. And at that point, I was starting to think about creating my own magazine and actually had bought a URL and commissioned Louise Feely to create a logo. And Steve and I were going to do this with Zach Pettit, who was the former editor-in-chief. And we had made mm-hmm. like pretty serious inroads. And then a year later, and probably a month before we were going to launch our magazine, they came back to us and said, "Oh, we're interested. Put in your best offer." At that point, I put in an offer, never heard back. And then I was talking. So Laura Desenfant and Deb Aldridge helped me with advertising for Design Matters. And they said something about, "Oh, we hear that Print Magazine is back on the block. We're thinking about putting in a bid." And I'm like, "Really? So Steve and I are too." And so then we'd heard that Andrew Gibbs and Jessica Desio from the Dialine were also putting in a bid. And so we all decided to get together and do it together. And that's what we did. So it was really three. I don't know if there were more parties that were interested. It's very possible there were, but we didn't have that information. So the three parties, Andrew and Jessica, who were from the Dialine, Laura and Deb from DNA, and Steve and I, we pooled our resources and we bought it out of bankruptcy, which is a miracle. A miracle.
And recently the site relaunched, it has a brand new design and everything.
Yeah.
What can people expect from the new print? Would you call it the new print?
No, I think it's still very much, you know, we're trying to get all the archives available. I would say it's a newish. Okay. Because I want to respect where it's come from, but clearly we intend to make our own imprint in and on it. I mean, I'm hoping at some point we can bring back a print magazine, but right now we don't have, you know, the funds to be able to do that. But hopefully we'll be able to raise it. Really want to try to bring a lot more diversity, a lot more relevancy to what we're doing. And we're working really hard on that and bring new voices to the world while respecting where the brand came from.
What do you think about the state of design media as it is now?
Well, I don't know if I'm really qualified to talk about that, only because I don't know everything that's out there.
Uh-huh. I think you have a good idea, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, between your podcast and print magazine, that's like 60% of design media right now in terms of, you know, output and importance, you know?
Well, I think that there's a lot of really great podcasts out there. I mean, I think, and I think that this is a reckoning that everybody has to have right now is, you know, how white is everything? And, you know, years and years ago, somebody wrote to me out of the blue, somebody that I didn't know, and she had taken a tally of the diversity on Design Matters and called me to task for it. And she was right. I tried to make an effort ever since that I try to bring as many voices to the table as possible and really be aware of my whiteness and trying to be really, really cognizant of bringing diversity to my show. And it's hard. You know, I got criticized last year for not bringing enough Asian voices to Design Matters. So it's, you know, I'm trying as hard as I can. Initially, when I first started Design Matters, it was before I was out. You know, I was trying to bring more women's voices. And then when I came out, I was trying to bring more LGBTQ voices. And now I'm trying to bring as many Black and brown voices as I can to the show. And so I'm trying to keep my responsibility really clear and try to lead by example if I can, the best that I can. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely not doing enough. I'm definitely not doing enough, but I'm trying every day to do more. And as far as the state of the design media, it's historically been all white, all male, all straight. And I think that it's slowly changing, but it's not changing fast enough. And I'm doing what I can to make a difference in my way. And I know it's not enough, but I'm trying to do more every day.
That's so interesting that you're getting like criticism in terms of the diversity of guests. I mean, I think that's a fair assessment, but it's one of those things where, I mean, like I get criticism for Revision Path all the time. Usually it's, well, why don't you have more Latinx voices? And I'm like, because it's, and we've had, you know, Afro Latinx folks on the show, so it's not like I'm neglecting that, but it's tough because sometimes audiences just want to see themselves reflected in the media that they like. And oftentimes, you know, depending on what that media is, that's just not, I wouldn't say it's not a possibility, but it's, I don't know, it's difficult. I mean, I don't know how you structure your show, how you find guests, like what makes for like a good Design Matters guest. But I would imagine that probably also falls into, you know, kind of making sure that you respect the diversity that people are calling for you to have on the show, right?
Yeah, I mean, I started the show with very little, with no expertise. I mean, there wasn't even, I think the word had just been invented when I started. And I was doing it as a sort of Hail Mary in my life. At the time, I felt like all of the work I was doing was commercial. I felt that I was beginning to lose my creative soul and started Design Matters really as a creative endeavor, self-generated creative endeavor that could help me find my creative spirit again. And at the time, you know, it was very inside baseball, designers talking to designers. Over the years, it's evolved to a show. It's evolved a lot. It evolves all the time because I think that is what keeps things fresh and interesting. You know, I didn't even have a logo for the show for the first 10 years or so, mostly because I wasn't considering it an endeavor that needed to be branded. Mm-hmm. Aaron Draplin gave me logos when he came on this show because he's like, Debbie, it's really time to get a logo. And then I didn't use his logos because they didn't feel like sort of me, but I appreciated them and talk about them a lot. But
yeah, I think all of Draplin's logos are just him,
right?
in different iterations, different sort of, you know, permutations of Futura Bold or something, yeah. But they
were really wonderful. And then the show started to evolve. I wanted to interview more than just designers. So now in an effort to try to keep the show making sense, I've tried to re-engineer the purpose as the world's most incredibly creative people talking about the design of their lives. And mm-hmm. So I get criticism a lot about that too. You know, I thought this was a design show. Why aren't you talking to designers? You know, so I think that when you put work out in the world, you're always, always going to get criticized because that's just the nature of the world. Some people love it. Some people hate it. When you change, some people love it. Some people hate it. And now that I'm with Roxanne, you know, I get hate mail about some of the diversity on my show, and that's just too fucking bad.
You get hate mail?
Mm-hmm. First time in my life I've been getting it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm very surprised to hear that. Only because I've been getting hate mail for years, but I'm surprised. Yeah. I mean, what do people say? I'm not trying to go down this negative road, but I'm just, your podcast has been such a mainstay, not just in the design industry, but in the podcasting industry as well. I can't imagine what people would be trying to, well, I don't know. You tell me. What's...
Oh, just racial slurs about me being gay, about me being with an African-American woman, just terrible things about me being Jewish. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus. I know.
Now you've
completely thrown me for a loop. I was not expecting that. My goodness.
Yeah.
How has it been just in general, though, doing the show like in quarantine?
Terrible.
How so?
Well, I used to do my show in a beautiful, tiny little studio at the School of Visual Arts. So it was really intimate. I get to look at the person deep into their eyes. It's a very sacred experience for me. I have generally turned down most interviews when people can't do them in person because I feel that the work I do really requires sitting in front of someone face to face, two feet apart, you know, and now that's just not possible. And I was trying to do the show through Zoom and had all sorts of technical difficulties. Now I'm trying Zencastr, which means I can't look at the person.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I was thinking, well, maybe I just won't do the show until we can get back together. But then I was getting a lot of email, please do the show. We're missing the show. And, you know, I get a lot of email about the show. So I hear from people very, very regularly. And so people really seem to want me to do it. So I one time I didn't record myself really well with the guest that I had. She sounded great, but I had a backup recording going on my iPhone. We had to use the backup recording. It's really hard to do a podcast when the first, you know, the 15 minutes before you go on the air, you're like weeping because the technology won't cooperate. As you can probably tell, I cry a lot.
How have you kind of seen podcasting change over the years? I mean, you started 15 years ago, right?
Yeah, 2005. Oh my God, it's changed from people not knowing what it was to now everybody knowing what it is and rolling their eyes when they hear you do one. just what the world needs, another podcast. Like, no, I've been doing it since the beginning. So.
So with the show kind of, you know, taking this place in design history, and it certainly sounds like, I mean, one, just from the mail that you're getting, good and bad, but it sounds like there's certainly an obligation. Like, I feel like you have a really strong obligation to the audience to make sure that you're representing them. How do you make sure that you're still represented in the show?
I don't know, actually. I think that I'm always represented in the show just because I always am there. And that's my voice. So I do take it really, I take that responsibility really, really seriously. But I don't really worry about being represented just because I think that that's just sort of an intrinsic part of it since it's my voice. I've become less interested in maintaining the status quo with my show in terms of, you know, if I want to evolve it from just design in the sort of classic graphic design sense, then I'm going to do that. I talk, well, you know what, now that I'm thinking out loud, you know, I'm very represented. If you just look at the topics that I talk about now, we talk about politics, we talk about sexual violence, we talk about race, we talk about economics, equality. I mean, these are the things that I'm passionate about. So I do think that they are very well represented in the questions that I ask and the people I invite to be on the show.
Yeah, that's something when I was doing, well, I mean, I'm still doing Revision Path, but certainly when I think right around the time Trump was elected in 2016, I felt like that was the first time that I felt my show kind of take a shift. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, leading up to that, we had been talking to designers and developers, et cetera, but there was certainly this event that had happened in the world, really in the United States, but it has, you know, world-ranging repercussions. And it was something that neither I or the guest could escape when we started talking. So I think it was the week of Election Day.
Yeah.
And I had an episode that I was doing with, interestingly enough, I did it with this young woman. Her name is Maya Patterson. She's Maya Gold now. She's a product designer at Twitter. But at the time, she was working at Trunk Club in Chicago. And we, you know, we had an interview already scheduled, and I was thinking, how am I going to put this on the calendar for later on? Because we started talking and we just went right into politics, and we just talked about, like, how are we feeling and what's the state of things right now? And we still discussed her work and everything, but it was very much it just happened of the moment. And we ended up putting it out as a bonus episode. It's one of our highest or most downloaded episodes. But it's something that, you know, at that point I felt a shift because, and you probably can attest to this too, you know, everything that we deal with in the world is designed. It's through some lens of design.
Yeah.
And I think if there's anything that the past 4 years have shown us is that design is a crucial tool that can be used to misinform a lot of people.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, whether it's ads on Facebook or doctored videos or Photoshopped images, et cetera. I mean, design is now, or it has been sort of weaponized in a way, and it's used to foment discord and a number of different things. So I end up working it into the show. Like, we'll talk about things that happen in the news as they happen. Of course, we talked about the pandemic. We've talked about the protests that have happened, and we still try to wrap it up into what we do as designers and what we do out in the world, because it's all a part of the world that we live in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do feel that I have a responsibility to talk about things that really matter and make a difference. And, you know, years and years and years and years ago, back when I was writing for Speak Up, for Armin Witt's website, mm-hmm. I had written about how as writers, we can talk about making a difference, or we can make a difference. And when I started the show, I found that phrase because Don Hancock of Firebelly had used it in a Speak Up poster contest. And I didn't even know that I'd said it. And then, you know, I found where I said it and decided that that really did represent what I felt was important for us as communicators. And so I started using that phrase at the end of every show. We can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. And I just changed it, and no one's noticed it yet because it's just been, I think, two episodes, but I changed it to, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, and we can do both. Because I think we have to, and that "and" means that we have to do it wherever we show up and however we're communicating. And for me, you know, I've grappled pretty much my whole life with wanting to make a difference, but mostly because I felt like I didn't matter. And that was a way for me to try to buoy up some sense of meaning and feeling like I had some sort of purpose. And I still grapple with that a lot. And to feel like I have a place where I can tangibly show up and maybe provide a point of view that can help someone or can enlighten someone or entertain someone, you know, that for me, that's where I guess, as you asked before, I bring my voice or my whole self to what I'm doing.
Yeah. It's amazing how, especially now during this time when, you know, so many of us are inside and we're reading more, listening more, et cetera, how a podcast can almost become like this really intimate audience of one in a way. Mm-hmm. It's you and the person that's listening. And so you know, even when I think about how I do for Revision Path, I mean, what keeps me coming back, at least right now, is that knowing that on the other side of the microphone, not just the person whom I'm interviewing, but the person who might be listening later on, like, we're creating that safe space, that connection that they may not be able to get any other place.
Right. And also, when you're listening to something, and again, I'm just thinking out loud right now, but I think that there's something really interesting about hearing an idea in your ears, in your head, and not having anyone else weigh in on the validity of that idea. And so if it's something you haven't thought about before, you know, maybe you'll take it more seriously because there's no peer pressure. There's no sense of what it means to reconsider something that you hadn't considered before, or to reconsider an idea that you had that might not be the best idea for the world. So, you know, I do think you do have an opportunity to share vulnerabilities and ideas and a point of view, and also and challenge people in a way that might be, you know, safer, so to speak, although a slight eye roll with that word.
I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about design organizations. Of course, I've done my research, and I think everyone who knows the work that you've done knows that at one point you were president of AIGA, one of only five women presidents of the organization. And this last month or so has been interesting for design organizations.
That's a kind word.
I'm trying to be kind. It's been an interesting time. Well, I think there is, you know, in one stage, there is this reckoning of the history of the organizations and what they may have contributed to in terms of the design industry. But then we've also seen, at least what I've seen on Twitter and have not tried to get involved with, but we've seen like these dust ups that have happened. Most particularly, I'm talking about AIGA. I'm talking about Type Directors Club.
Right.
I can speak about both objectively, not being a member of either one of them. So as it kind of relates to the modern designer, do you think that organizations like these are still relevant? And if not, how can they be more relevant?
I don't know, Maurice. And, you know, I was on the board, the New York chapter board for 2 years before I joined the national board. I joined the national board, I think, in 2006 and became president in 2009, was president until 2011. I'm not a member right now. I haven't been a member for some time. I was given the medal last year. My remarks for giving the medal were very important to me, what I said. I shared sort of my full experience. My experience with AIGA has been high highs and low lows.
Mm.
You know, I joined the organization back in the late 90s, and was so excited because this is where all the designers were. You know, this was where the creme de la creme was. This was where the legends hung out. And I joined and was part of what was then a brand experience group, which I was very excited about because I had been dying to find community. And here was something that seemed like the Venn diagram between graphic designers and brand designers. And I did that for 2 years. I was on the board of this little group. And then when it came time to be on the board again, everybody had to be revoted, and I got rejected and sort of kicked to the curb because my work was deemed too traditional. And I was super devastated because I had enjoyed being part of that so much. Then 2003, after I got kicked off the board, Rick Raffet, the then executive director, asked me to participate as a juror in the 2003 Design Annual, which I did, and was very excited and really honored to be part of that. And that didn't go that well. Again, I was criticized for the kind of work that I was doing at the time, you know, branding. And then when that annual came out, the anti-AIGAers saw that my name was in the book and my work was in, and the credentials that were there were like the Burger King logo and I think the Star Wars identity we had done for the packaging for Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. And so then I got a lot of hatred online about me being a corporate clown and that the AIGA had sold out. And I was like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. I got kicked to the curb. I'm not an AIGA or by any means. So there's been a lot of history there for me with some online, I guess you'd call it bullying, but it, you know, at the time that wasn't the word, but it felt very, very painful to me to have that experience. It's called a she devil. But then AIGAers started to reach out. Emily Oberman, who was the then president of the New York chapter, invited me to be on the New York board. And I'm like, do you know my history here? I didn't know. I didn't want to tell her at first because I thought she might take back the invitation. But then she said, oh, no, we know. And that's why we want you. And so then I got back involved with AIGA. And then big time, I then moved to the national board, then became president. And anybody that knows me well knows that my 2 years as president were two of the hardest professional years that I had. It was so difficult. I can't even describe how difficult it was.
What made it difficult?
Differing opinions. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had one board meeting where people didn't fight, where I didn't leave the board meeting feeling completely crushed. It was very hard. The part of AIGA that I think is remarkable are the chapters and the chapter energy. And because of how much difficulty I had feeling so excluded from AIGA for so long, when I became president, I made a promise that I would visit every chapter that existed at that point. And I just went on the road and visited as many chapters. I think I visited over 50 chapters. Yeah. And met with everyone I could. And my goal at the time was to be as inclusive as possible and to build the web presence online with social media. And I spent a lot of time trying to improve the way that we communicated on Twitter. But, you know, this was 2009, 2010, 2011. And AIGA had a really big following on Twitter. And so I felt like that was an important place to show up. And I tried my very best. One of the things that I felt was really important with AIGA when I was president was to embrace the student population. I don't know if people know this, but about half of the members of AIGA are students. And I felt that they were underserved. And so I also spent a lot of time working with student chapters and visiting student chapters and talking to students. And that's always been something I'm interested in. I mean, that's why I teach as well. But in terms of what's happening now, I mean, I'm not surprised. When I left as president, I was supposed to have an additional year on the board, but gave that up so that they could bring another woman on the board, which shouldn't have had to happen. I wanted another woman president to follow me. I wasn't able to make that happen because I didn't have the power to do that. So I left feeling very unresolved that a lot of the work that I had done, I wasn't able to do the way I wanted to do. There were a lot of questions about diversity that I felt even the board was pushing back against. People were concerned about being tokens, and I felt that it was important to have a very clear point of view about needing to have diversity. And there were concerns that conversation had passed, and I'm like, are you kidding? And so there were outright fights. I mean, I remember Bennett Pezzi crying at my first board meeting because of he felt that the work that he was doing in diversity might go away. And I didn't want it to. And someone else felt that, you know, that conversation had passed. And I'm like, it hasn't even started.
Yeah.
So it's been really challenging. I saw what was happening online. I was very upset about what was happening. No one had reached out to me, and no one has reached out to me. No one at that point had reached out to me since I got the medal. So I wasn't clearly being invited to the conversation. Mm-hmm. And then Christine Taylor reached out to me, and we had a very long talk. And I was very excited. The next day I was invited to a town hall that they were having about diversity and inclusion, and was really, Maurice, I can't even begin to tell you, I'm like, oh, yay, they're bringing me back in. Roxanne was excited. We were going to sit and listen together. She had been at the medal presentation when I got it last year, so she was very aware of how involved I'd been in the organization. And then about 7 minutes before the meeting, I got disinvited. And my Zoom link was canceled as if I was going to try to go in anyway as a bad girl. And I was just devastated by that. I was devastated. And I did something that I maybe don't know that was the right thing to do. I went to Twitter. I'm like, how
bad is it? Well, that's the thing now. People go to Twitter to air their grievances.
I know.
And it worked. I mean, they paid attention.
And I got a whole slew of phone calls, but nothing has happened since then. And I hope it does. I still hope it does. I'd love to be involved. I'd love to help, but nothing has happened since then. And I'm not surprised, but I'm still hopeful, Maurice, because I do think that if anything, we have an obligation as designers to be more inclusive. And if AIGA has 20,000 members, then there's some power to make that happen. And it's necessary. And, you know, I can tell you firsthand now, I'm a conventionally looking white woman. And now that I have been in a relationship with an African-American woman, I can tell you firsthand how much racism she encounters on a daily basis. Going into a store, being followed around, being treated in a different way than I do when people don't know we're together. And I see it firsthand. So I feel it firsthand. And so I know how much work needs to be done. And I'm here to help do it if I can. But if anybody thinks that that conversation has passed, I will say it again. The conversation has not started.
Yeah. I'm not surprised by any of that with AIGA. None of that surprised me, just in terms of the way that they've acted and the way that certain, I don't know. I find that chapters are kind of much better to deal with than dealing with headquarters in general. I've always said that AIGA is only as strong as its weakest chapter. I do believe Atlanta might be its weakest chapter, but I wouldn't say I'm sort of biased because I live in Atlanta, but I just have had instances where, like, look, I can do work for National. I don't necessarily want to do it for the chapter, but even, you know, when you're mentioned about the town hall, like I won the Stephen Heller Prize in 2018 and went to the gala.
Yeah.
And I remember first of all, I was just extremely excited about it. Rented a tux, went to New York and everything like that. That was fun. The next month I had brought Cheryl D. Miller. I actually had brought her to AIGA headquarters, and me and her and Julie Annixter like sat down and had a long conversation for 2 hours. For folks that don't know, Julie Annixter is the former executive director of AIGA. And that summer, I had actually been going to different chapters, just, you know, talking about diversity and inclusion stuff, talking about things with a vision path. I went to AIGA Portland. I went to AIGA Philly. And it was maybe later on in the year, like around September or so. And I was, you know, I had gotten a new debit card. And so I was going to all my online memberships and swapping out the numbers. And I go to AIGA and saw that my membership had been canceled.
What?
I was like, canceled? What happened? And I go and check the date. And it's 10 days after I got the Stephen Heller Prize. They canceled my membership. I didn't get a phone call. I didn't get a postcard. I didn't get any sort of communication to say, hey, something's going on with your membership or what have you. And it had me thinking like, oh, well, should I re-up? But then I really had to think about like the 3 years that I put in on the D&I task force and how we had to fight tooth and nail for everything. I mean, even the smallest little mention of something on the website took 5 or 6 meetings. And there was just so much red tape that we had to cut through. And I mean, we were all volunteers. Like, none of us are getting paid to do this.
Right.
We do this because we know what the organization is about. We're passionate about diversity and inclusion. And we were just kind of getting talked to like the help, essentially. And I put in 3 years, which really was 2 years. It was 1 year longer than I should have been on. I was there for 2 years and I stayed on an additional year to help out with a transition in leadership and a new structure for the D&I task force. But once that happened and I was like, should I renew at AIGA? And I really had to think about where I was as a modern designer. Like, I had my own studio. At this point, I had my studio for 8 years. And I was thinking, what is AIGA really doing for me as a professional designer at this point in my career? It's not with networking, because I could do that through my show. I mean, what, 10% off Shutterstock? Ooh, that's, whew, that's great. That's not really anything that I'm really that passionate about, you know? And it even wasn't the meetings. I mean, I would go to meetings at my local chapter and they were okay, but I never felt like I was being filled and sustained and really a part of a larger community. I mean, even going to those meetings wasn't super diverse in Atlanta.
What?
Like, I would go to these meetings and still be one of the few Black designers there. It's ridiculous. So I just didn't re-up and I didn't make a big stink about it. I think I might have made a mention on Twitter. I think I might have said I was going to renew and then I decided not to. And then AIJ, of course, jumped in my mentions and were like, oh, that's so sorry. Well, you should have gotten an email. Well, I didn't. So that's that. I still end up getting involved in AIGA things because I know a lot of people there and people seek me out for, you know, just counsel, et cetera. But I don't know if AIGA really has a place right now with the modern designer, especially when I think about the different types of design that really AIGA historically hasn't really made space for. Because AIGA has kind of been a traditional graphic design, print type of an organization in terms of the type of design that it recognizes and showcases. But if you're a UX designer or a product designer or something like that, it can be hard to look at AIGA and think, where am I in this organization? Like, how do I, as a modern designer at, say, a company in Silicon Valley, where do I fit in with such a traditional stay-at design organization?
Yeah. And I think that's reflected in the name, you know, the American Institute. Graphic designers were so much more. So I think that I love communities. I love feeling like I'm part of something bigger than myself. And I love being able to work collectively. I think that there's something really special about that. So I do think it would be wonderful if there was some collective or cooperative or community where people can come together and learn and be inspired by each other. But I think that that whole model does need to be redesigned.
Yeah, I think so too. Absolutely. Now that you've kind of reached this point in your career, I'm curious, what deals have you made with yourself to maintain the level of success that you currently have?
Ooh, that's a big question, assuming that, you know, I feel successful.
Do you feel successful?
Not really. I think that for a long time in my life, I was trying to achieve in order to feel better about myself. And that comes from, you know, a really rough childhood and feeling like, again, you know, I didn't matter. And so over the years of therapy and a lot of introspection and work and so forth, you know, I've come to realize that no matter how successful, and I have quotes around that word, you might seem, you know, if you don't feel a certain way inside, it's never going to be enough. You end up just being a sort of bottomless pool of need. And so I've been working a lot on what that means and how to really have a full life with and without external achievement. But then I also have been doing a lot of thinking about what it means to do your best work. And I've quoted this before from one of my shows. I interviewed David Lee Roth, the former frontman of the band Van Halen. And I asked him in our interview what it felt like to be the biggest rock and roll band in the 80s. You know, that was it. You know, they were it. They were the, you know, they were all over MTV. They were all over the media, all over the press, and seemed to have everything that one could ever want if you were a pop star or rock star, and you know, the literal words. and I asked him what that felt like. You know, what did it feel like to be the biggest rock star on the planet? And he said something to me that I think about, I think, every day. And he said, you know, when you reach the top of the mountain, there's really a couple of things that are pretty universal. You're almost always alone. It's always cold and there's only one direction to go. And I thought about that a lot. You know, what does it mean to peak? What does it mean to have your best work behind you? And I don't want to peak. I don't want to peak. You know, I don't think Milton peaked. You know, Milton was still working about a month or so before he got ill, really. Wow. And I'd like to feel that I was contributing and making things that felt like they mattered, you know, for the rest of my life. So, I mean, I feel lucky which is a word that I never would have used to describe myself. I do feel very, very, very lucky, but I also feel like there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of things that I still want to do. So that's sort of the what I think about.
If you could spend the rest of your career like doing what brings out the real Debbie, what would that be? What would that look like?
I'm still working on that, Maurice. I'm still trying to figure that out. I am trying to be as sort of real as I can be. You know, I spent a lot of years hiding my history, hiding my childhood history, because I felt that I would be judged and people would think badly of me and less of me. And I've come to really be an advocate now for eradicating sexual violence. I denied my sexuality until I was 50 because I felt like I had my own inner homophobia and felt that I would be perceived in a bad way, and now really understand what pride means. So I didn't really start like fully living my life till like 50. And so I'm still in that first decade of being, trying to be honest in the world. And so I think maybe my visual stories are things where I feel like I do bring my full self. I'm really trying to bring my full self to the podcast. And really, truly, the place where I try to do it every day is in my relationship with Roxanne. You know, just to be fully, fully who I am. And she's the first person in my entire life that I've been in a relationship with that I can say she really knows me, knows every aspect of me. And for the first time in my life, I feel loved.
Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? It's 2025. All this COVID-19 is a thing of the past. Like, what does the next chapter look like for you?
You know, that's a lot. That's a big question. I've been thinking about that a lot because, you know, Roxanne has her house in LA and I have my house in New York. So I definitely see myself still doing the podcast because I love doing that. I definitely see myself still drawing and making things because I'm really happiest when I'm making things. I'd love to still be teaching, not so much online because I love being with students in person and sort of having that in-person experience. I'd like to keep working to make the world a better place if I can in my own small way.
Well, just to kind of wrap things up here, where can the audience find out more about you and about your work online?
Well, I'm at debbiemelman.com, and that's where you can see a lot of my writing and a lot of my work. Oh, I know one thing I'd like to say about that in 5 years. I would really, really, really like the rape kit backlog to be done and over with. I would like every rape kit that is conducted to be analyzed and processed within 48 hours. That's what I would like to have happen in 5 years. Done. No more rape kit backlog. So that's a really tangible goal that I would like to see happen. You know, the way we treat our rape victims is indicative of the way we treat people, and we have to do better.
Yeah.
So debbiemelman.com, and you can also see the work that I do for Joyful Heart Foundation there, and also the joyfulheartfoundation.org, and on Instagram and Twitter, just Debbie Millman.
All right. Well, Debbie Millman, I have to say this has been a real... I don't know if I can think of the right word to say how this interview has been. It certainly has been transcendent in that, you know, I'm able to talk with someone who has been such a foundational mainstay, I think, in the design industry for so long, but also just the fact that you are so open about what you do and the work that you do and who you are and that you bring it to everything that you do. I mean, oftentimes, and you probably know this from interviewing people, sometimes you talk to someone and you can tell when they have the wall up or they've got the guard up, like you're getting the scripted answers or something like that. All I got from you was just abject warmth and honesty. And I just thank you for allowing the space for that to happen in this conversation. So I don't really know what to say. I'm kind of tongue-tied a little bit, which is rare for me on an interview, but
thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. And for anybody that's listening, and I'm sure there are lots and lots of people listening, I am going to invite Maurice to be on Design Matters. So I get to turn the tables. It's been very hard for me to not ask you questions.
I am looking forward to that. I love doing interviews, so I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. So stay tuned. This is just part one.
Well, thanks so much for listening. Like I said, this is going to be the first in hopefully a series of these Share the Mic Now episodes. The intent really is to be able to try to share more of these voices. I would highly encourage you on your platform and in your own way to try to do the same. I think, you know, this is a real time for us to be able to hear a lot of these other perspectives. And like I said, I'm more dedicated than ever to doing it. Until next time, thank you so much for listening to this. Thank you again so much to Maurice and Debbie. And as always, stay crazy.